How well do you know your friends? Heather Amy O'Neill is my friend. For more than a decade, we've shared meals, cups of coffee, family vacations, and countless conversations about how to build a creative life in the midst of domestic reality. We've talked about marriage, children, ambition, art, money, time management, and the strange business of trying to make things while simultaneously living a life. I know I have revealed much of myself to Heather over the years, often huddled at the end of her long dining table in the Bed-Stuy apartment she shares with her wife, Caroline, and their two children. I would tell her about balancing commercial work, the podcast, tour life, and my own songwriting ambitions. And she would tell me about her work as a teacher, editor, and writing coach, and about how she balanced all of that with her own writing practice. Which is why, when sometime last year she announced that she had sold her first novel, I was stunned. She sold a novel? She wrote a novel? How had I missed this? Then again, I guess everyone has a secret. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Looking back on it, I think Heather had been telling me all along. I found a text exchange with her from October of 2024, where she wrote, "I have a character in my book who speaks Spanish. Can you tell me if this is correct?" I answered her matter-of-factly, never stopping to consider the larger story hidden inside the smaller one. What book? It turns out that while we had been talking about creativity for years, Heather had quietly been writing a novel, not telling her students, not telling most of her friends, not telling me, just writing it, mostly, as she later explained, on Thursdays. Heather once told me that as the youngest of her sisters growing up on Long Island, she never felt like the main character in her own life. She felt like an observer, and I think that has been one of her great gifts. She was paying attention while the rest of us were busy talking. I didn't notice her noticing me. That is a superpower. When someone you love makes something, there's always a risk that you won't love it as much as you love them. So when Heather's debut novel, The Irish Goodbye, arrived in the fall of 2025, I cracked it open with equal parts optimism and apprehension. I said a small prayer. Please be good. And it was very good. The Irish Goodbye tells the story of three sisters returning to their family home on Long Island for Thanksgiving, each carrying grief, guilt, and unresolved questions surrounding the death of their brother years earlier. It's a novel about family, memory, loss, secrets, and ultimately the challenge of living an authentic life. I saw pieces of Heather in it, of course, but what surprised me most was how quickly I surrendered to the story and forgot about the person who had written it. It was a gift to discover that I wasn't simply proud of my friend, I was a fan. As it turned out, I was not alone. The Irish Goodbye became one of the most celebrated debut novels of 2025. It was a Read with Jenna selection on the Today Show, and it found a wide audience drawn to its emotional depth, compassion, and sharply observed characters. For its publication, Heather asked me to help her launch the book at a bookstore in Brooklyn. Preparing for that event, I had the chance to ask her about the writing process, the characters, and what she felt the novel was really about. And as I watched her that evening that we presented the book, in front of a packed room of family, friends, students, and readers, I began to really notice her. The Heather I knew was still there, thoughtful, observant, curious, funny. But alongside her stood someone else, a novelist completely in command of her own narrative. So as much as I loved the story she told in the book, I found myself increasingly curious about the story she hadn't been telling me all those years. Or maybe the story I hadn't been listening carefully enough to hear. That's the story of an observer stepping into the frame. The story of someone who has come out more than once in her life, most recently as a novelist, and in doing so, seems to have come in to her own. We got together recently to talk about all of it. Third-story.com is the place to visit the archive, hundreds of deep dives like this one, including conversations with other writers like Lori Moore, Emma Straub, Peter Coyote, David Marinus, Daniel Levitin, Alan Lightman, Clifford Irving, Warren Zanes, and Jake Lamar. Also, Heather and Caroline inspired my 2023 interview with singer Stacey Kent. Visit my Substack for writings and episodes. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for all of their award-winning content. Here's me and Heather Amy O'Neill talking it down. Let me just hear you talk for a quick sec.
Hello?
Yes, say more.
Hello? If you have any advice on my voice, like is it too high? Is it too girly? Is it too fast? Is it too enthusiastic?
Is it too teenager-y? Today or in general?
In general.
Heather Amy O'Neill, we've begun.
Okay.
This question that you've just asked me, if I have advice about your voice,
yeah,
to me suggests that you at this moment in your life have suddenly had to confront the fact that you've become a public person and like a media person. Because I can't imagine that over all of the years of you working as a writing coach with people or a teacher or a writer in more or less obscurity, that this was a question that you were worried about.
No, it absolutely wasn't anything I ever thought about until I had to do it, until I sat in front of a group of people. And in fact, the first experience I had with it was in Greece the year before my book came out. I was leading a retreat in Greece, and they wanted to do a faculty reading, and I didn't realize that they wanted to do that. And so I had no plans to do that. I had not prepared to do that. And as somebody who grew up with a reading disability, reading out loud always terrified me. Hmm. I don't still carry that disability, but I can, when I'm in that position, I can return to that childhood self. So I very much did not want to do it. And all of my students who are like long-term students, some of them were new, were like, you absolutely have to do it. And so I had to sit in front of this entire group, and I was with another writer, and she was very dramatic and performative in this like beautiful lyrical way. And I felt like I just got up there and like read from the page, you know? There was a Q&A session, and it was just my first experience being in that place. I was terrified, and I left feeling like, okay, I'm going to have to figure this out. And I don't really think I did much to figure it out, but it was a shift in perspective. Like, oh, you know, I've spent these decades behind the scenes, behind the curtain, where I've felt very, very comfortable. In fact, the more successful I was at my job, the more you couldn't see me, you know, as an editor. And now I had to kind of stand on the stage and figure out who I was in that space, because I really actually didn't know who I was. It was somewhat disorienting.
I mean, behind the scenes, behind the veil, I think for years was the place where most writers got to live, because you get to live on the page. And you are sort of, I was going to say coming of age, although you've sort of come of age, but you're coming of age professionally, publicly, and as a novelist in particular, in a period when the expectation is that you also have to cultivate your public persona and be somebody that maybe your readers kind of want to be friends with or be like or aspire to be like, or, you know, some version of a public-facing person.
Yeah, and I think when you do that when you're in your late 40s, it's an interesting it's almost like trying to learn how to ski when you're in your late 40s. Mm-hmm. Like, I learned how to ski when I was 3 years old. And so I was like this high off the ground. And so I was, and you know, I had no amygdala. And so I was like totally fearless and able to go down the mountain. But I know from friends who have tried to learn how to ski when they're, you know, past 5 feet and in their 40s and worried about breaking their knees, it's a much scarier endeavor. And yet you can be more thoughtful about it, you know? So I think like when you have success when you're younger, maybe like in your 20s or even in your 30s, I think maybe there's a little bit like, I mean, I don't actually know, but I would imagine that there is a little more like confidence in it. Whereas when you're in your 40s, you it's almost like the more you know, the less you know. You're aware of how much you don't know.
As you say, you're in your 40s, you've been a writer for a long time. I know that you've been a teacher and a coach, and I knew you as a poet originally. Mm-hmm. And through all these conversations about the creative process and about helping work with other people, and yet through all these conversations that we've had, And we've been on vacation. Our kids know each other. Mm-hmm. Our wives know each other. It's a deep friendship. Mm-hmm. You did not say any time, I'm writing this novel. I mean, the first time we heard about your novel was after you sold it.
Yeah, that both surprises me and does not surprise me. You know, on one hand, I think, how is it that I didn't share this? And on the other hand, I think, of course I shared it, but I must not have. Certainly you would have known. You would have remembered. It wouldn't be something that you would have forgotten.
Well, so but you're saying it's not something that you intentionally hid from people.
No, I think I do tend to be a very private person. Maybe private isn't the word. I don't know. I think like you, actually, I tend to be more interested in other people, you know, than like really, really sharing stuff about myself. And whether that's a defense mechanism of some sort, or I think it's probably like a combination, right? And I have always struggled to feel comfortable talking about myself. I feel much more comfortable talking to other people about themselves. So that's been like a huge shift. There's so many reasons for that, but I was surprised to find out how many people did not know I was writing a book. Like I have a small group of writers that I have been teaching in a small class for years. I meet with them every other week. And when I told them that I sold the book, they had the same reaction of like, wait, what? You were writing a book? Maybe there's a part of me that wasn't talking about it that much because I wanted to see what would happen with it. You know,
I mean, I can totally understand why one wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Both the internal pressure of making this thing is so great already, and the external pressure of, well, what are people's expectations of what a success would be and what is supposed to happen with this? And you hadn't done it before. And actually, I mean, part of what was so surprising to me about it wasn't only that you had taken this on and gotten it done, because it's easy to say, I'm going to write a novel. It's much harder to write a novel. Mm-hmm. But also that there is a certain kind of ambition and desire attached to it. Like, you know, if you're going to take that on, there has to be a part of you that has the hope that you'll sell it and that people will like it. And so there's a certain amount of ambition attached to writing a novel, which I think is also sometimes can be hard to confess.
Yeah, actually, I think that you're probably getting closer to a truth. There's a vulnerability to it. There's a vulnerability to admitting that you're trying something, you know? It's much safer to hide behind the kind of mask of I help other people, right? And I had tried to write novels before and have like my own unique experience of why that they didn't work out. And I hadn't tried to write a novel probably in a decade from the previous novels that I had attempted and sort of put in a drawer. And in that decade, I think I learned so much as an editor and as a teacher, and finally felt like I want to try this again. And then I had this idea and I began to work with my friend Nancy Rawlinson, who was helping me in the same way that I had helped other people, which was extremely enlightening because it was helpful to me as a writer, but two, it was really helpful to me as a teacher and as a coach because I, you know, to some degree, you're isolated in that space. You're just doing that work one-on-one with a writer. And so she taught me in multiple ways. So I think there was somewhat of like a vulnerability in admitting that. It's almost like saying, I'm going to go out and seek love or something, you know, it's like, it's so abstract and it can feel so elusive.
I've been saying I'm going to reach peak hotness by the time I'm 50.
See? Fantastic. Yeah, I like that. Whereas now, I mean, and again, going back to our earlier conversation about where I feel more comfortable, and I think actually this is true for a lot of writers and artists, it is behind the scenes. And to put myself in the space of like talking about my own work and admitting my own ambition.
Yes.
I was afraid of failure.
Sure.
I think that's true.
Do you think you were more greatly afraid of failure having been the person that coached other people, or
It's interesting because I have a lot of friends who are independent editors and coaches who really shifted at a certain point in their life and realized, like, I don't want, you know, started out as writers and shifted to focusing 100% on doing that kind of work. And I think that's so entirely respectful. You can be a great writer and not a good editor. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be a great editor and not a great writer. They're yes. not always the same thing.
Sure.
Sometimes they can be the same thing. And I used to always, I always had this kind of, you know, my as my editing and teaching career was becoming more and more successful and I was working with such extraordinary writers, I would think to myself, why can't you just be happy with this?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you just be happy with this? This is going so well. You're doing so great. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't. There was this part of me that just like ached to do this other thing. And it was a real burden. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was a burden that kept me going.
Kept you going while you were writing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've heard this before, that the only thing that can make a writer more miserable than writing is not writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, but I actually, I find so much pleasure in writing. You know, I mean, it's hard, but I enjoy the process so much. It's so meditative for me. It's the one time in my life where I feel like time doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could have a day of like, I don't know if music is like that for you.
Yeah, I think it is like that for me. And I think maybe what I'm experiencing in my life right now is kind of similar to what you must have gone through and maybe still do. Like, I punish myself or I beat myself up when I don't, when I'm not able to find time to do my own writing. And in my case, I guess my writing is songwriting.
Yeah.
And the reason I don't have time is because I'm busy interviewing people and writing about that,
yeah.
or I'm busy writing music that has been commissioned in some way.
Yep.
But I still feel like I'm failing myself when yeah. I don't make the time for my quote unquote creative practice.
Yeah.
And so I relate so much to you saying, I wasn't satisfied. You know, you kept saying to yourself, isn't this enough? Why isn't this enough?
Yeah.
Because it's not like you weren't flexing a version of that same muscle.
Sure. And I found that work, I do find that work yeah. deeply satisfying.
Yeah.
If you're a good teacher or good editor, good producer, you know, good podcaster, good performer, right? Like you show up and you perform, it takes so much out of you. And it's hard. Like I've never been able to not give so much
yeah.
to my students. And I don't say that as a martyr because it's not just for them. I know that that's a two-way street, but I have to figure out the balance of it, you know? And so now one of the things that's been great is that I can do it on a smaller scale. So I don't feel that drain.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I can still kind of give to the people that I'm working with without compromising the time that I'm spending on my own work. But I know that struggle so intimately. And whether it's like you're a teacher and you're an artist, you're a parent and you're an artist, that thing inside, it's a little bit like a hungry ghost.
Yes. Yes.
It's really hard to feed it. And it can feel, to me anyway, it can feel almost addictive.
Now,
I don't know if you feel it.
This
like
is something
addictive.
I think that we have not talked about, actually. Uh-huh. Yes, it is very hard to feed it, and you are a great parent and a devoted parent and a devoted partner. And maybe that's part of what was so surprising to then read your novel and realize that you had been feeding this beast throughout all of that time, because it's insatiable, of course.
And it is, yeah.
And success doesn't do it any favors, you know, in the sense that then you start to feel, you know, where do my allegiances lie and what do I prioritize?
And the goalpost continues to move.
Which is wonderful. And it's wonderful. That's
sure.
what I, it's wonderful to watch that happen to a friend. You said something about how in the, let's say, the decade between your last attempted novel and The Irish Goodbye, which is your first published novel, that you learned a lot about maybe what didn't work originally. And some of that maybe came from editing and coaching other people. When I read the book, one of my first thoughts was, you really understood how to keep a story moving in a very compelling way. Short chapters, cliffhangers, there was something quite cinematic about it. You could really picture it. I think everybody who's read it started to cast it in their mind. And you just were unafraid to tell something, a story that would really be catchy in its way.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember reading it thinking, I wonder if some of this is just having seen what works in other people's writing.
I was reading so much and I was reading so many other people's work. And
yeah.
I started to have this feeling of like, okay, what's this about? Where's it going? What's this about? What is she doing? Why is she doing it? Mm-hmm. And that definitely informed the way I told the story. I love a good sprawling novel. I mean, Anna Karenina is one of my absolute favorite books ever.
Yeah.
But I do also recognize that there's something about today's reader that wants to kind of move through a story and wants to be moved on a kind of emotional level, but also stay there. And I know the feeling of just like wanting to go pick up the book again and figure out what's going to happen next. Caroline and I were just listening to The Correspondent, and I think she did such a great job with that as well. Just like different plot lines, different character intersections, you know, that kept you questioning what's going to happen next. But the other thing I would say, and I don't know how music works with this. Maybe podcasts are kind of your editing of podcasts might be similar. Is that you have to have so much material and you have to be in that place of discovery for a long time in order to figure out like what could be cut away, what can be trimmed.
Well, this is what I think is so, like I was saying, intimidating about novels. I mean, first of all, the idea that you might create characters, plots, story that then you kill.
Yeah.
That goes away. Yeah. It existed and then it went away. There was a time when they did this and now they don't do that anymore.
Totally.
And that's a kind of a death in a way. And that's hard for me to understand. And then also I think, you know, novels are not just plot and character. There's so much of an author that shows up in internal monologue and in small interactions between people that I just think must be the result of having gathered so much material in life. I just think you have to have observed a lot of human nature.
That's very true. You know, like I'm going to misquote him, but James Baldwin talks about how when he began to read, he recognized that his heartache wasn't unique and how wonderful that was. I know that experience. And I think we all do when you're reading or you're listening to a song, like a lyric, and you think, oh my God, yes, that has happened to me, or I did not know somebody else has had that experience or thought that way or felt that way. I'm constantly mining for that. There's almost, I think, and I'm curious if you like how this works or how you feel like this might work from a music perspective, but there's something kind of anthropological and maybe even disassociative about it that can happen when you're in that sort of observational lens in the world. You know, there's times when I'm like having an argument with my wife or like trying to negotiate something with my sons.
And you step back and observe it while you're in it.
Yeah. I definitely do not think you can only write about things that you have personal experience with. I'm more in the sort of Toni Morrison, like let your imagination kind of expand to incorporate all of humanity. I mean, try to do it responsibly, I think, but I'm very resistant to this idea of limiting yourself to your own experience. I know that that's something that's like some people really advocate. I just think that if you're going to do that, you have the potential to limit your own imagination. And I think when you're trying to write a character who's had an experience that you have not had, I don't know. I mean, as a writer, it does require you to flex those muscles of empathy or to try to find like the commonality between your experiences in unique ways. And I think sensitivity readers are great things. And
what are sensitivity readers?
So if you're writing about a character or a situation that you don't have experience with, you can have a reader who does have that experience read it and just check it for elements of like authenticity and is there anything here that's like a trope or offensive or inaccurate. So when you're talking about sensitivity readers, you're looking at elements of like race or gender or, you know, sexuality. But I think that's true. I mean, if you have a character who is a pilot and you're not a pilot, you know, I mean, I'm constantly calling my sister Melanie, who's a doctor, and asking her like, okay, if the character is feeling this, what could be the situation?
Right.
You know, so having those resources.
Sure. To only write about experience that you have had would be to limit the imagination. And on the other hand, there is that one essential truth that seems to be that the personal is universal, and they say, write what you know. And to return to the Irish goodbye, my memory of the way you got started was that you wanted to explore what happens to a family in the wake of September 11th.
Yeah.
Because your own family and personal environment was so deeply impacted by September 11th. And you know, the fact is, we've talked about this, and yet I don't know the full extent of what that meant to you.
So my father's company, Stanley O'Neill, was on the 104th floor of the South Tower. He was out of town. He was on the West Coast at that time. I was actually out of town too. I was in North Carolina on a beach trip. And when the plane hit, it was obviously very confusing. Oddly enough, I was asleep in bed and I'd had a really bad dream. And I woke up and I was walking into the living room. It was like a beach house and you have to go upstairs, you know? And my ex at the time came running down the stairs and said, a plane hit the World Trade Center. So I called my mom immediately and she said it wasn't their tower. And I said, okay. And then, you know, within however many minutes, the second one was hit. Ultimately, my dad's company lost 68 employees, including my cousin Peter, who had just started working there, graduated college. And because there were so many young people there, my sisters in particular had a lot of friends who, after graduating from college, went to work with my dad. So my sister Meredith, her best friend, Christy, she died. You know, it was just this horrendous experience and so surreal, utterly life-changing. And when I sat down to write about that, I didn't want to write about my family's experience, but...
But your idea was maybe you look at different family.
A different family, yeah. And so the character in my book, Topher, who's the brother and son, I originally had him dying on September 11th. I think I had him as a firefighter, actually.
And did you have this general structure of the family, of the three sisters and the mother?
More or less, yeah.
So you had the size of the family, and are they in a beach town?
Yep.
So a lot of the pieces were in place, but the death happened very differently.
Yeah. And in my book, there is a kind of stranger comes to town moment in the family where the oldest sister, Kate, invites someone to the dinner, and that kind of disrupts things. In the original, it was the character of Topher's ex-wife who comes. And it
It's not stranger that comes to town, though. It's a ghost from the past.
It's a ghost from the past. Yeah. That's true.
Because when you said that, I was saying, well, the stranger who comes to town is actually the youngest sister's girlfriend.
Isabel. Yeah,
she's the stranger. She's the stranger
who
comes to town.
That's true. Yeah.
But so a ghost from the past comes to remind people about this loss in a way that they maybe haven't wanted to think about in a while.
Yeah.
So you had all of that in place. And I know that at the core of the book is this idea of how tragedy runs through a family and how people respond to it and the secrets they keep and what they say and what they don't say and how it haunts people differently over time. But by removing it from September 11th and placing it the way you do, there's much more of a sense of responsibility and onus on the characters in your book than there would have been if they had been lost in September 11th.
Yeah, that's true.
And in a way, I think that's a big part of the power of the book.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there was some intention with that. I think certainly with suicide, it's such a complex grief. And, you know, especially with men, it's so prevalent. It's really devastating. One of the reasons that I chose suicide was because I wanted to choose a complicated death. I have lost people to suicide, and, you know, that certainly impacted me. But additionally, I would say one of the biggest reasons was having lost so many people I loved on September 11th was a unique experience because the loss was global. And it's this event that people talk about. And people talk about it without knowing that you've had this experience. And so you know, I mean, even when you first, just a couple of minutes ago, said to me, like, tell me about it, I felt like my whole body kind of like freeze.
I realize as you're telling me that I asked you in such a casual and cavalier way, like, oh, yeah, tell me about your law experience of losing people. But it's because I don't. Right.
No.
It's like a loss that belongs to all of us. And yet some of us experienced it more acutely, profoundly, directly.
Right. And I mean, comparing my loss to my aunt and uncle's loss of a son, comparing Christy's husband, Brendan, or my sister, you know, losing her best friend. There's all of these different, obviously, like shades of grief and loss. But over the past two decades, I have had the experience of being in conversation with somebody and, you know, something very casual will come up. Like, this is one that always gets me. Because it's been said to me before. I can't really think of the context of how it would be set up. But if September 11th is a conversation that comes up, sometimes, oftentimes people will want to tell you their story if they were down there, right? Which, of course, I mean, how traumatic. And there is something about sharing it, I think, that feels like cathartic. But sometimes someone will say something like, yeah, I mean, I, you know, I was so close. I saw people jumping out of the building. And I'm hearing that as, I mean, that's obviously so profoundly traumatic to watch that, right? To have that seared into your memory. I'm also experiencing that story, the sharing of that story as, I don't know if that's somebody, if they're talking about somebody I know, you know, because we have no idea what ultimately happened. And so having to be in this kind of space of having those conversations and letting them be and not sharing my experience because it's weird or it's personal or whatever.
And grief is not a competition.
No,
it's so easy to get into a thing where you want to claim your grief.
Yeah.
And when other people are sort of stepping forward and feel that compelled to share it with you, it's like, well, you don't know what I've had to go through.
Yeah. And it's, and you just never know. Caroline and I were at a dinner party a couple years ago and the people there were, I don't know. They were kind of interesting. I won't say much. But anyway, they at one point late in the night, this one guy started talking about it. And he was talking about September 11th. I don't know why. But in those kind of like pretty awful details. And I mean, I just felt like this panic emerge within me. And Caroline actually said something. And I felt both relieved and mortified by her intervening in that way.
Mortified in what sense?
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
Going back to vulnerable, right? Put on display or like asking for something, you know, asking for this, I guess asking for this like gentleness or, you know.
Or to be seen.
To be seen. Yeah. To suddenly be spotlighted, you know. So I have been aware of how often that kind of stuff can happen with suicide. You know, people will reference things like, oh, God, I'd rather shoot myself than do that. Or
kill me now.
Kill me now. Right. How often those things are said. And I'm sure I say things all the time that
I mean,
realize.
Our kids say, I'm dead. I'm dead.
Yeah, I'm dead.
I'm dead. Dying. Yeah. We say dying.
I say it.
Dying.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit grappling with this thing that's so interesting about how personal experience works itself out through fiction, because all of this is happening when you're writing. You're not writing autobiography. And I know that it happens, you know, among my writers, friends. It always comes up where people ask the most cliche question. It's like, well, is this you?
Yeah.
And it's like, yes and no.
Yeah.
Some of these things did happen to me, but not exactly this. And, you know, it's in that space between real and pretend. And sometimes the things that we create are more real than the real things.
That's true. I think as a writer, I also recognize that there are limits, right? There's certain perspectives that I just am probably not going to be able to enter. And I don't know what that like point of entry is. I don't know what limits one writer versus another. I mean, I think that there are male writers that write beautifully from a woman's perspective.
Sure.
I'm reading Elizabeth Strout's new book right now, and she writes beautifully from a male perspective, or at least from my, you know, I don't know what it's like to be a man, so.
It's so hard to talk about these things and not worry about saying the wrong thing sometimes.
How do you feel about that as a jazz musician?
I think you have to acknowledge, and not in a performative way, you have to actually recognize that jazz grew out of the Black American experience. It is music that was created in the wake of slavery, but it also totally reflects the American experience
sure.
of immigration and
yeah.
intermingling of culture. It's a truly American invention.
Yeah.
It also then became a language and a way of traveling. And that language can be spoken fluently and credibly and authentically by people who found it all over the world. And it's inclusive and flexible, mm-hmm. and it can accommodate all kinds of personal voices and cultural narratives yeah. and different yeah. kinds of folk traditions. I mean, jazz, what's so wonderful about it is that mm-hmm. it is so accommodating.
Yeah.
So now it's hard to say mm-hmm. where the music lives because it has affected so many people. I mean, it's a virus.
Yeah.
And then you get into the subjectivity of, well, I love jazz that still contains elements of the blues and swing and the, yeah. the sort of the essential building blocks of it and the pieces of it that it contained originally. But there are plenty of people that are making versions of jazz music, or some people have renamed it Black American music. Other people mm-hmm. call it this music or okay. improvised music. Like everything else, there are all these different ways of virtue signaling your feelings about the music.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But I mean, I guess the point is, like, authenticity, I think, comes down to personal authenticity more than any set of traits or characteristics that you yeah. can claim.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're saying too.
Well, you just said it so beautifully. I very much think that that's true about writers, going back to like the voice, the question of voice, trying to understand someone else's lived experience.
Yes.
It's extraordinary how some writers can do that. Ian McEwan in Atonement does that from this like young girl's perspective. Mm-hmm. And she's in her room and she's like writing. And it's been maybe 20 years since I
yeah.
read that book, so I might be misremembering exactly what she's doing. But I related to it as a kid
yeah.
so much, you know, like that experience. And I even remember reading Anne Frank when I was in middle school, her desire to be a writer and the crush she has on one of her girlfriends,
yeah.
you know, like, I don't know if you would call it a crush, but she sort of is thinking about it in that way and just feeling so connected to it, you know, and God, I mean, talk about how different our lives were.
Well, I know it's hard for me not to think as you're describing that. We joke about you being a gold star, but like already knowing that you came of age at a time in Long Island in a community that can be quite conservative.
Sure.
In a large Irish Catholic family, I would imagine there was maybe some stigma around being gay. I don't know, but.
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, I had a gay uncle and my parents and my grandparents were all very socially liberal, but I think it was more, it was like an unspoken stigma. You know, it's like,
yeah.
it was just, you know, I always joke that when I was in high school, I
yeah.
very much knew I was,
yeah.
I mean, I didn't use the word gay,
yeah.
but this was an honest thought that I had when I was in high school. I was like, clearly I'm not gay because I don't look like the women who I identify as gay, which was, you know, not to be stereotypical, but it was my gym teacher. And my math teacher. So I thought, well, I'm not gay. I'm straight, but I just have crushes on girls, right? Because it was like I did not have a single person in the world reflected back to me what I felt I was.
Yes.
And that was a weird experience. You
yeah.
know?
Was your gym teacher and your math teacher, were they out?
Not publicly, but they were so clearly gay. I think they may have even been together. I just was like, I don't see myself. That's
yeah.
not. And there was probably some degree of like homophobia in that because I didn't relate to how they looked or how they presented themselves or how the world received them,
yeah.
right? The students received them. And I didn't want to be that way.
Yeah.
So my high school and college, so much time I wasted trying to figure out how to not be gay.
Right.
I mean, it was utterly exhausting. What I could have done in that time is really remarkable.
I mean, it's so interesting, though, to think it's not that you felt that you were supposed to be straight for any moral reason or anything like that. It was that you
yeah.
didn't feel that you looked the part of
yeah.
being gay.
It was both. It was like I didn't want to I just didn't want to be that,
yeah.
that thing,
yeah.
you know? And I do think yeah. in part because I didn't have anybody who I felt reflected other parts of myself,
yeah.
you know, that were important to me.
I guess what I was thinking is like, there's this weird assumption sometimes that by signing up for one thing, you have to sign up for all of the things.
Yeah.
That if this is true, then it must also mean that all these other things
yeah.
are true. And it's not, you know, the experience is as vast as the number of people there are on the planet.
100%. Yeah. Then I had this weird experience of when I did come out, which was like the late 90s, I learned, and I don't think yeah. this is true as yeah. much anymore, but at the time it really was yeah. a truth. I learned that feminine women in gay relationships yeah. are not matched with other feminine women. And I was a feminine woman and I was attracted to other feminine women.
Yeah.
So I was further restricted. And I thought like, okay, here I am. I'm now going to come out and I'm going to be able to live my life. And I just immediately hit this other kind of gatekeeping and, you know, was told like, no, that's not the right thing. You're not supposed to be like femme. That's not really a thing. And I was like, what? You know, and again, this is like really before the internet
yeah.
and it was just utterly confusing to me.
Yes.
And so once again, I felt like I don't fit in here either.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that. And I think honestly, going back to the Irish goodbye, I began wanting to write about grief. But the more I was writing it, the more I began to see I am writing about the journey of these three women trying to live an authentic life. And that has been a journey of my own. And the book I'm working on now, it's two women, and basically their narrative could be summed up in that. How do I learn how to live an authentic life? And I do feel much more comfortable in that, but it took me a long time to get there.
I'm glad that you said that about the new book and also what this book is about, because part of what I'm thinking as we talk about your experience of writing The Irish Goodbye is, oh, well, in the end, you ended up pouring so much of your life into it, both the experience of grief and the three sisters and Long Island and
yeah.
and the gay character, but then also the relationship with mother. I mean, just so many things mm-hmm. in there. And one of the characters is a kind of a writer adjacent character, a teacher. There are just so many pieces of you, I think, that are in it. And so mm-hmm. it's easy to say, oh, well, you wrote your personal narrative novel. But of course, you could explore the idea of authenticity 100 times.
Sure.
Or other aspects of yourself too, because I'm sure there are so many parts of your life that have not been tapped at all in this book. I know
yeah.
there are.
Sure.
That's kind of fascinating to me also. Like, yeah, of course, each one of these books is an opportunity to like explore another facet of, let's just wait for this to.
Okay.
Hi. I'm talking to Miso, not you.
Oh my God. He is really the cutest.
I think he's settled down now, so I'm going to leave the door open.
Okay.
I remember once we were talking about how when you are a creative person living in the chaos of just life,
mm-hmm.
how you said earlier that when you write, sometimes you lose track of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure actually for the people around you, it seems like I can say something to Heather. I mean, she's been writing for 2 hours.
Sure.
I can go in and
yes.
say something.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm in the middle of something.
Oh, that's the story of my family life.
Yes. And yeah, mine is too. I feel so lucky that I get to make all this work in the middle
yeah.
of the house. And it's also just like, where's the soundproof vault that I get to go to?
Yep.
And nobody comes in.
Yeah. Rachel Zucker has a great quote, I'm paraphrasing, but she's talking about how sometimes, you know, she'll be in the middle of an essay and she'll have to stop to go pick up her kids or go to the grocery store or something. And she feels like she's a heart surgeon stopping in the middle of a like operation in order to like go do these domestic things. It sounds dramatic, but I think if you're an artist, and what we were talking about before, that kind of addictiveness, that the addictive quality of wanting to be in the work.
Yes.
It feels that urgent. It feels like, yes, I just have to keep doing it.
But how do you know when you can put it down then? Because I mean, it's true with all of our work, but certainly true with writing that, you know, you look at yesterday's pages and you pick up and you start again. So how do you know when you can put it down?
I have an answer to this question and I'm so curious what your answer is. For me, it's when I begin to see that the work is not going well,
yep.
that I'm making it worse and my energy is tapped and I'm getting kind of confused. No, you know, not confused, but I'm not able to focus,
yeah.
I guess. I have such hyper-focus
yeah.
that when that begins to
yes.
to waver, I'm like, okay, I need to step away or I'm going to make things worse.
Yeah.
How about for you? What's your signal?
I think diminishing returns for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe it is that focus thing. I relate to it In songwriting, I relate to it where it's like I'm just constantly returning to even just like the notes app in my phone or whatever. Where it's like, no, it's this. No, wait, hold on. The lyric is this. It needs this word. Hold on. And then I walk the dog and I'm still talking. You know, I'm just like, as you say, you want to live in the work. You want to live in the work.
Live in the work, yeah.
As opposed to struggling in front of the page and like, okay, I did it. I put my half hour in, but it's not really going anywhere or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing, though, how those breaks, like taking the dog for a walk, taking a shower, can really open up things.
And dishes. So many songwriters I talk to
about
doing dishes.
Cooking for me is a thing. I love that.
You have thought things come to you when you're cooking.
In fact, I keep my computer next to me while like on the counter because I'm constantly taking notes.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is a kind of a boring and tired question or not, or if it's, you know, significant, but like it did seem to me that the book was a success.
Yeah.
This was a success and now you have to do it again.
Yeah, it's again going back to the sort of the private self, the worker self, right? Yeah. Like the one doing the work as opposed to the one talking about it or performing it or whatever. You know, I'm so much more comfortable as the one doing the work. I love working.
Yeah.
I love writing. I love the process. I love thinking about it. I love reading. I love editing. I love really all of it, even the parts that are hard. If I had the choice of just like existing in a cabin and typing away and then putting the pages out of window and somebody out there like does something with it.
Yeah.
My hope would still be that what I'm producing lands with the reader and means something and is received well. But in a way, you could never tell me what happens. And
you'd be okay.
I'd be okay with that. I would prefer to just keep working. That's not a reality though, right? Like that's not part of it actually. I think that maybe there is a maybe like a immaturity to that perspective, right? Like
there's an equal immaturity to craving the adoration and the adulation.
To just wanting to be outside the cabin.
Yeah, and
right?
Just have seeing everybody tell you how much they love you and or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I think that's true. Like either there has to be a balance, right? You have to kind of figure that out. But I would say that in the journey I'm having post the publication of The Irish Goodbye, I'm working on this second book. That instinct or that desire to just be in the cabin has served me well because I can compartmentalize fairly easily. There are times when something will crack and someone will like say something to me like, did you see that thing on Goodreads? And I'm like, no. And don't tell me. Oh, well, you know what? This is what they said. I'm like, no, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Did you read reviews?
No.
Didn't read any reviews?
Other than a review in the Irish Times. I have not read. Nope. No, I don't want to, right? Because that will crack my you know, that will knock the shed down and I'll have to rebuild the shed. And right now the shed is really working for me in terms of helping me be productive with this next book. Maybe at some point someone will just knock the shed down, you know, like, or the shed will blow down. I don't even know. Like I have this deadline for the next book of September 15th and that's a very tight deadline. And I've been working really hard on that. And I'm really invested in this new story and excited about it and in this kind of place of discovery, which feels so great. You know, we were talking earlier about like observing the world and pulling that into your work. And I'm curious how you do that as a musician and podcaster. But for the past, I don't know, maybe 2 years while The Irish Goodbye was going through editing and, you know, the final stages, I didn't have a place to kind of like put those observations.
Yes.
And now I'm in this place of having a place to put those observations. When I hear a really great line of dialogue or observe something or read something, I think, okay, is there a place for this in the new book? And that's so fun. So that kind of makes life more interesting.
Do you feel, but sometimes you might have to hold them for three or four books into the future. Totally. I mean, you can't squeeze everything into every story.
No, no. There's a line in The Irish Goodbye about oysters that I held on to like for 15 years. Right. It's my friend Mike said it, you know,
What is the line?
One of the characters asks Kate, like, how do I eat an oyster? Yeah. And she says, with your mouth mostly, unless you're a barbarian and you can chew it a little bit. I asked Mike if I could use that line because he said it once. You know, just we were at the beach and I was like, that is a great line. I love that. But, you know, it took like 15 years to put it in, to do something with it.
And what's so funny about that is a just a little tiny moment in the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a little tiny thing about oysters. Yeah. It really doesn't particularly move the story.
No, it's so small, you know. But those you sprinkle things in there. People have asked me a lot about how sibling order impacts the characters in this book. And then how that translates into my own life. And I've said that as the youngest child, my sisters were, you know, much older than me and closer in age to each other. And I think that there was something about being the youngest child in that role that nurtured the observer, because you're not the main character, you know? Your sisters or your siblings who are older than you, they have exciting things going on.
Yeah.
They're doing things that are teaching you how to exist in the world, how to speak certain languages, what music to listen to, what clothes to wear, how to navigate your parents, do things differently, do things similarly. So you become the observer, you're almost like an, you know, there's an anthropological element to it.
Yeah. What has changed for you?
I would say one of the biggest things that has changed for me is that I don't have that ache, or that ache has been replaced by kind of a drive to move forward. It feels more like a motivation than a burden. The other thing that has changed for me is, you know, when I was writing The Irish Goodbye, it took me like 4, maybe 5 years to write. And I wrote it on Thursdays. That was like my day to work. I didn't have any meetings. I didn't do any editing on those days. And so that kind of sustained me, you know, when I was exhausted from teaching and editing on the other days, I knew that I had Thursday to focus. And now it's kind of the opposite. Now I
have every day but Thursday.
Yeah. Like now it's like more like a 3 to 2, maybe 4 to 1, where I get to write more. And that's been an enormous, enormous shift.
Those Thursdays, did it feel long or short?
Short.
I mean, did it feel long, the space between, the distance between Thursdays?
Long.
Sounds so long, having to write a novel on Thursdays.
Yeah, I mean, I would write on the weekends too.
Yeah.
But mostly it was Thursdays. But I would take the whole day. I've always been, I don't know if you're like this, I've always been the kind of writer that I really appreciate like a long stretch of time. I'm not great with like if I only have 2 hours. I want like 8 hours.
My main creative engine is procrastination.
Oh, interesting.
And I get my best work done when I'm avoiding doing the work that I've decided or been tasked with doing in the moment.
Okay,
I write songs
when I'm
on deadline
for
something else. I do podcasts when I'm supposed to be writing a song. I do it all at the wrong time.
Interesting. Do you feel like, is that a process that you have embraced, or is it something that you think is problematic, or is it working?
I have a list today that is hour by hour of what I told myself I'm going to do. And none of that will happen other than you coming at 9:30 to the house. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know that. For sure. I know that.
I still believe as recently as right now that I'm going to somehow change the way I work. It seems like productivity is tied to being overcommitted. And by committing to do less, it doesn't seem to make me engage more deeply with the work. But if I have too much to do, then I manage to get a lot of it done. And
that, then I think that makes a lot of sense. Talking about process, with The Irish Goodbye, working on it on Thursdays, and maybe this had something to do with, like, to your point, like the long stretches of time in between Thursdays, the labor of trying to figure out what the story was going to be took a lot more time. It took maybe like 2 years to like really figure it out. Whereas with this book, having this deadline, and it's such a tight deadline, and just being forced to like knock out, I'm basically a chapter a week, just a draft at least.
Why is that deadline so tight? Because in order to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be pushed if the work is not strong enough by then. And I don't, like, it's not, my publisher is not, you know, breathing down my neck or anything. It's just like, oh, if we're going to make this book that's released in summer of 2027, it needs to be kind of wrapped up by this time. But it doesn't. That's not necessarily.
And then edits delivered by January or something.
Yeah, whatever the timeline is. But it's a completely different way of working for me. And it's kind of, I kind of like it. Like having to, it's stressful.
Heather.
Yes.
Let's wrap the formal part of this conversation up. I'm like shocked that we talked so much about me here.
One of the things that I so enjoy in our conversations is having a conversation with someone trying to figure out how to live life as an artist, you know, and all of the different factors that go into that, the journey of that, the process of that, the logistics of it, the kind of spiritual, emotional, psychological elements of it, and
the financial aspect.
Oh my God.
We've talked so much about
time management.
Time management stuff. How do you organize? Yeah. I write on Thursdays. I do these days. No, it's true. And actually, I think when I look at it, like maybe part of that sort of connection, maybe part of what we've bonded over the years is that like that realization that, we're both like we're sitting having dinner or on this trip with our families or whatever, but we're both actually in the middle of something.
Yeah, always. Always. I've joked that people who are not artists, like, I'm like, what do they do with their minds all day? Like, I mean, that sounds ridiculous, right?
I feel the same way.
It's like, obviously, right? If you're a doctor, if you're a mechanic, if you run a coffee shop, you have all of these things in your head. But like having a project keeps my mind from kind of like going crazy, you know, in many ways. So.
When Soul was born, I remember saying, what did we used to do? Were we just at brunch all the time? what were we doing with our time?
It's so true.
But it's the same thing with, what is going on in people's minds if they're not like worrying about this thing that they're making?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think entrepreneurs maybe think about it all the time. I mean, everybody thinks about it.
And I always say that I would have like more organized closets. I would have more time. But
I pulled the curtain before you came because I didn't want you to see my clothes stacked up on my
dresser. I would judge that so much.
I know you would. Heather, thank you for not judging that so much and for just being such an open book with me.
Likewise. It's just,
I love and cherish these conversations.
Same. How is my voice?
Perfect.
Thanks.
There she was, my friends, Heather Amy O'Neill. See what she did there? She flipped it on me. Thank you, Heather. I love you madly. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.